that goofy looking stuff on the front of it there. I took that out, that and several other pieces out to the horse track a few years ago because Little Richard was playing out there, and he's an old friend of mine from Soul City days, and I took these things out there to show him, and I left them in the room, in his dressing room, while he was on stage, intending to come back and pick them if I just wanted him to see them. I came back and he had written all over that said something like, you know, bless your family or something like that. And then I had a maid that came in and thought somebody had defaced it, and she kind of wiped most of it off.
No.
Well, you can still see it. I can. Yeah. I'm thinking all I need is a
don't touch it.
Like a detective kit.
Just to put it back in. Yeah, you can see where he put it.
Oh.
So.
Oh, it's a great story.
Oh, Richard was always funny. There are a lot of true geniuses in this business, you know. But that's how I got into music, was because of Little Richard.
Let's start there.
Oh, okay.
Because some of the first things I ever found out about you was that you were booking people like James Brown and Little Richard in like the early to mid 60s, when the rest of us were watching these people on American Bandstand or on Ed Sullivan and stuff. You had relationships with these people. I mean, mere mortals wouldn't even.
Well, they did. You know,
how did you know how to get a hold of these people?
Richard? Well, he had
any
agent.
Of them.
Because they all had agents. You know, you could get hold of anybody.
No, I couldn't. You could.
Anybody could call the agency and they would quote something for you or you answer a question or something. They just didn't know to do it.
Who was the first band you ever booked? How did you start booking bands?
Well, those were pretty isolated times. I remember the first one I ever booked was a band called the Atmospheres that were out of Highland Park. I was in the seventh grade, and there were several of us kids that were having a party, you know, a sock hop type thing at Hodges Hall and at the YMCA over here on on Preston. And I knew these, you know, who we had their record, as a matter of fact. And I booked another group that was better known called, oh God, what was their name? They had the song So Tough. I don't know if you remember that, the backbeat, original backbeat version, you know, because they were the only white people on the label. And they were kids that went to Highland Park too, and one of them taught my brother guitar.
Wow.
So it was just casual note, you knew somebody, you know, like that.
What gave a seventh grader the moxie, though, to, how did you have access to even, you know, just start booking bands? The rest of us.
Well, these were one shots, way far out. I mean, I never booked the Atmospheres again after that. You know, or this other group. God, what was the name of it? I can't remember right now. But anyway, I didn't really book anything else until I was in college.
And where did you go to school?
UT for about 20 minutes.
Okay. Yeah. But it got you to Austin?
Uh-huh.
Okay. And what did you find there that looked like opportunity for you?
The opportunity that I found was a guy that who was senior in our fraternity I was in, who said, "You're the pledge class social chairman. Go find us a band for the next party."
Okay,
I never found a band in my life. But I knew these guys here in town, these black guys, a man named George Harris ran it. His wife owned a beauty shop salon, and he had marcelled hair that went, I mean, would have given Prince a fit. I mean, it was amazing. And this guy played, it was a great band. It was kind of like, you know, a modern day. I mean, it was a typical local band that played a lot of the hits, and these were mostly black hits, and that's what everybody wanted to hear then.
Wow.
You know, so his he looked so mean. This guy had a, the most forbidding visage. You know, you'd look at him and he'd look at you, and that's why they the name of the band, everybody called him Jolly George and the Checkers.
Great name.
Jolly George was the band of the day for a while. And that's that was my first.
So when, you know, when a movie like Animal House came out, you must have just sat there and gone, "Oh my God, this is my life," right?
Yeah. Well, not really, but there were some things in it that I thought were really humorous. I mean, especially the part where they're in the nightclub.
Right.
I lived through that.
Okay,
being the only I started going to a club over on Hall, Hall and Thomas. Called it had been the Rose Room, but it was now called the Empire Club. When I was a kid and going in there, and they let me in if I was dressed in a suit.
Oh, you
know, everybody dressed up big time to go out in those days.
Okay.
So I'd go in there and you know, they'd just leave me alone. Nobody said anything to me, you know, except "Hello, how you doing?" stuff like that. And because I was by myself most of the time, sometimes I'd have a date, but I was kind of tetchy about it because I didn't know what to expect. But these people were really, really nice to me, and I wound up spending a lot of time there and learning a whole lot about how the business works. From a little guy who had an office in the front of that building called the Branch Agency. His name was John Henry Branch, and he was my introduction to the professional side.
No kidding.
Of the business. He taught me how to write a contract and everything. He just did it because he liked, you know, we liked each other, stuff like that. And he wound up being you probably had seen him, Doug, at a lot of the Shoko parties, because he was always invited, always there. Little short guy with bald head, 9 fingers and 1 eye.
He blended right in.
Oh, he was fascinating to me because he had been when Ray Charles moved to Dallas, they hooked up, and he found him a house that he wound up living in for 3 or 4 years, and he started booking. He had been booking it for years and years. He had been a trumpet player in orchestras and bands and stuff. He knew the whole business. But what was I going to say about him? Oh, he had to teach Ray how to live on the road. Ray moved here right fresh from Sacramento. I think it was Sacramento. Seattle, where he had been a Nat King Cole copyist. I mean, he copied him. That's how he did it. And he moved down here, and John Henry got him to kind of interested in trying to go back into church, you know, music. And that's where he really made his way. But John had to teach Ray Charles how to sleep in a ditch. Okay?
Sleep in a
Yeah, because they'd go out and play some little town far away from here, and it'd be so late at night, they were just exhausted, and they couldn't stay in any hotels, so they'd have off and sleep in a ditch. And that was the true story.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah, well, that's like the drums beating, you know. You find out from somebody who's done it before. Yeah.
Did you see that movie Green Book?
Green Book.
You haven't seen that movie? It was based on the fact that black touring musicians in the South had to have this little kind of a homemade...
Oh, that one. I did see that. Yeah. Yeah, the little homemade book.
Homemade book about where they could stay.
And where they could eat and where they go could to the back door or front door. It was just really...
Exactly. And we forget that this, in our lifetime, this existed in our lifetime. And you saw it all up close. close.
Well, fortunately, I wasn't really that familiar with those kind of scenes, because those are real backwoods deals, you know. But all those acts that became famous,
they
all had to go through it.
Ike
Turner, my God, he went through, I can't tell you how many of those same things. And he was another guy I really admired, because he did so much for the music business. I mean, for the furtherance of rock and roll and R&B, you know, being a, I mean, if you're a talent scout for Sam Phillips, you know, you've kind of hit it a certain way. You know, he would go out and find Howlin' Wolf and find all these different people and turn them into Sun artists.
You know, and Ike Turner did that.
Huh?
And Ike Turner did that for Sam?
Oh, yeah. He was Sam Phillips. He had a band that could work in the studio, the Rocket 88s,
yeah,
and so on. And then he had a wealth of people that wanted to record over there, because Elvis had been there. And yeah, it was definitely you taught somebody else who taught somebody else who taught somebody else.
Do you think that Ike Turner's story has not been told maybe in full or properly or on balance? Maybe we only...
Well, I advise everybody that has ever heard of anything about Ike Turner, go out and buy a book called I'm Taking Back My Name.
Okay.
It's his answer to Tina's,
okay,
you know, whatever. I mean, I know she was bitter, and I know, okay, all that stuff was on. But I tell you what, you know, people reference that movie.
Yes.
Is what they do, in which, you know, that giant guy plays Ike Turner, and little bitty, whoever it was, Angela Bassett,
yeah,
plays, who's not a shrinking violet herself. But in the movie, he was so much bigger than she was, and it showed him beating her up all the time. Well, hell, who's going to beat up his meal ticket? You know, he's not going to do that. They always had a physical relationship, you know, as did a lot of people coming up out of poverty like that. And you know, I've witnessed some of them myself. And one of them got out of hand, but the other ones weren't. I mean, it was an accident, you know, kind of. But as a rule, you don't tend to mix it up with your golden goose.
Okay. Let me take you back to these days when you were first getting into promoting and first finding some success in Austin promoting pretty much black acts, R&B acts and stuff like that. How did the British invasion affect those performers and your career? Was that a pot? You know, it's always represented, of course, as a big positive thing for music in general and rock and roll and stuff like that. Was that good for the bands that you were booking?
I'm not so sure that it affected anyone, you know, really one way or another.
Really?
Well, just because, I mean, it brought the fact that people, that British groups were recording things that were done originally by black groups, you know, it's like kids listening to Twist and Shout when it comes on. And then some wise programmer will say, and this tune, you know, really belonged to the Isley Brothers, and they'd show them doing it, and kids go, whoa, where'd that come from?
Yeah, Beatles didn't write that?
That's right.
Yeah.
And it happened so many times. I think it helped.
Okay.
I think it helped because they were showing that they appreciated the material enough to record it. You know, it wasn't like anybody was stealing anything. It was things that other people had. I don't know if I'd heard another version of it, you know,
true,
by then. It wasn't that. It was okay song and everything, but it wasn't a mind blower.
Okay.
So that would be my answer.
Okay. So the phone didn't stop ringing for you to book R&B bands. Then, like by 65, 66, you were still able to book these bands?
Well, that was the only time. That was when it started, really.
Okay.
I started booking these little bands when I was in school, but then I left school and moved to New York worked the World's Fair up there. That's where the Green Men came in. And it was, we were up there because my dad had built the World's Fair Music Hall up there and had a big production that was running in it that wasn't able to make it because, you know, the big guy who had put the fair together promised him all this traffic down to where this theater was, and he didn't provide it. So we had this huge production on our hands, and we finally had to close it down and move back here. And right about that time, the war was heating up.
The Vietnam War.
And I went down to Austin to get back in school when I got back in, and they said, no. He says, you've dropped out three times. Oh. You have to wait a year now.
Oh.
God. The first time I had to drop out when I was a freshman, both times I got mono and I couldn't take exams. I broke my back.
Oh.
On one time, falling off a girl's porch. Oh. I mean, I was trying to do it. Anyway, the war is getting real crazy, and I had some friends that were in this guard unit, Air National Guard unit out at Hensley Field, and I went and signed up in '65.
You're
because
kidding.
Well, I was either that or I was going to get drafted, and I was going either to be an Army guy or a Marine.
Oh, man.
You know, and that was the choice you had.
Wow.
But this way, it was for a longer period, but I wasn't, you know, on active duty the whole time. I was only on there for part-time. And I don't know why we're talking about that.
No, come on.
What brought it up?
No, that's all right.
Oh.
We're in the mid-60s, but you're alive.
I got in there. I signed up in 65. I didn't have to report for duty until maybe February of 66 or maybe March, late February, I think, because I went in, did my basic at Lackland, San Antonio, and I was moved to Wichita Falls, unfortunately, to that godforsaken Shepherd Air Force Base over there. And I went and did, you know, my technical stuff there, took a bunch of classes and stuff, and worked for the guy that was the general that was the head of the base there, who apparently had gone to school up east somewhere. And the second day I was there, I was looking, and the whole operation was run by kids, you know, kids that were younger than you were who wanted to see you sweat. And I thought, this is not going to be any fun. But they had us all come form up outside of our barracks one day, and he says, okay, is anybody out here who's not afraid of brass and wants to have an interesting job? You know, he said, not afraid of brass, and went to high school in the East, which I did. I went to high school in Lawrenceville, New Jersey, and this guy who was the base commander had gone to Choate or some, you know, another one of the schools up there that we generally trounced in football. And he said, I know what you guys think of this. You know, when you come up here and see what's going on, I want you to know there's another side of this altogether. So you can come up. Don't call me sir. Don't do any of that shit. Just run an errand every now and then. You can read the rest of the day if you want to.
Wow.
So I thought I was pretty fortunate by getting that duty. And I got there April 1st. And there was a foot of snow on the ground. And I left on June the 22nd, same year, marched in a parade. It was 117 degrees down in that old bowl. You know, Wichita Falls is the most miserable place for weather. And this is only a year or two after that tornado had just torn the whole place apart.
Man.
It was crazy. So I came back here that day and went over and leased some office space at the Quadrangle, which a friend of ours had just finished building and with his dad. And we were the second office in the place or something like that. And I had All I had was this bare office, which was a nice little suite there, and a Selectric. Anybody remember those?
The typewriter.
Yes, Selectric type, with a ball, you know. Sitting on the floor typing up contracts. And Jack was on the road with his band in Bossier City. And one of the afternoons, I felt compelled to see to go down and make sure that everything was all right down with him down there, you know, in Bossier City, it was the wildest ass place I'd ever been in. No rules whatsoever. The only rule that they had there was, and we knew this guy that owned the big club down there called Saks Whiskey A Go Go. And he loved soul music. The only thing wrong with it was he was on the strip at Bossier, and there was a law down there that you couldn't have black entertainers in your place.
Whoa.
So he used to come to Soul City, which we opened in 67, and see these people, and he'd just weep all the time. You mean I can't have Al Braggs there? No. It was crazy. But I went down and hung out for a few days, and then we came back here and started trying to book bands.
Okay. Now, I want to take you back to a couple of things.
Mm-hmm.
You brought up Jack. You brought up Soul City, and we need to fill in the blanks. Who's Jack?
I figured we could go back.
Who's Jack? When did you meet Jack?
Jack Calmes was a young guy that had gone to Highland Park and SMU, or still going to SMU. When I met him, we met by strictly bumped into one another in a listening booth at Ernstrom's Records on Lover's Lane and Douglas. And we were in there listening to records, and we started talking, and, you know, hey, let's do something, you know. Maybe we'll do a show sometime. Anyway, and so out of that came the thing that we did. Our first show really was at Market Hall on OU weekend of that year.
Oh, gee.
And we brought Chuck Berry in. And we didn't know anything. We didn't know anything. You know, had a stage. We had... At one end of Market Hall, we had all these tables lined up as a barrier so people couldn't come in without a ticket.
Well, all like we did was put, like cafeteria tables?
Yeah, you know.
That was your security. That was your security.
Yeah, we had one gal who was selling tickets down on
roll
one end.
Roll tickets?
Yeah, they were just those little cheap ass, you know, red tickets you get.
Yeah.
We were selling setups. You brought your own whiskey or anything like that. We could sell setups. And, man, people got in the damnedest fights in there. It was really amazing. We had the whole thing set up and broken down by fraternities. We'd sell fraternities, big blocks of seats, you know. And we had these little curtains in between each different section. Of course, those things went down immediately.
The first 5 minutes, gone.
You know, and I couldn't believe there was so many people that would just get so loaded before they even got there.
Yeah, that's true.
And would start fighting and everything, and they'd have to break it up. It was just one after the other. And we had a police detail inside so that we could escort the cash that we came in up to the counting room upstairs. And of course, we had most of Jack's friends had been brought in to bring the cash in, and these guys were all putting stuff in their own pockets full of stuff. We got ripped off. Anyway, we became fast friends with that. Chuck Berry, what I was going to say was... we put one little ad about this size in the OU paper and one in the Texas, you know, student paper. And out of that, we got, I don't know, we got 3,000 people, something like maybe more than that came in. And they all hit it once, and of course they were going under the tables and over the tables.
Right.
We learned how to prevent all this stuff through through firsthand experience. And Chuck, we learned that all rock and roll heroes are not necessarily cool. I.e. Chuck, I'll give it back to him anytime I can. One miserable guy that I don't want to do any more business with, and I don't think I will. He didn't die yet, did he?
He's still alive.
He's still there. He's kind of, but he's a mess. So I don't envy him.
No. CB died, didn't he? No, Chuck did die.
No.
Huh? Yeah, no. Chuck Berry did die.
No, there'd have been a big funeral.
Didn't Chuck Berry die?
He's got, you know, I mean, he's not working anymore. I know that.
No, he passed about 3 years ago.
What?
Didn't he?
Just lately?
About 3 years ago.
Oh, years. I thought you said
March 18th, 2017.
Yeah.
Shit.
Yeah.
Well, good. That's he was hopefully in poverty by then.
He was 91.
91.
Oh, he wouldn't even stick it out. Coward. He was always like that, though.
At least he was consistent.
Well,
no one had a good word for him.
Well, I'll tell you one good word I had for him one time. The only time, somehow this availability came up when we had the club, which didn't open until 67. Jack and I opened, and three other guys, Don Safran, who was the head of the Times Herald. He wrote all the amusements columns for the Times Herald. It's Don Safran and Stan Levinson, my next-door neighbor here, who had a big ad agency. And a guy named David Nichols that we didn't know. I don't know who knew him. Maybe somebody's in-laws or something. And so there were five of us. We each put up $10,000 and opened this club, which probably didn't. Actually, it wasn't that much because the whole club only cost about $10,000 to put in.
Wow.
And it showed.
Now, was this Soul City?
Yeah.
City?
Soul City was the name of it, yeah.
Okay, what was the name of the band? Soul Society?
Soul Society was Jack's later name for his band. He had the Jades at Highland Park, and then that changed over to Soul Society when they got horns and, you know, and they got the first Moog synthesizer that had been used.
So was Soul City the name of Jack's band, and then the club had the same name?
No. The club was Soul City. Jack's band was the Soul Society.
Got it.
Later, just Society. I think I wasn't around, you know, at the later part.
Got it.
Had some good players in it. I think David Alley was in it for a while, and several other folks you probably know. But I had an opportunity to book Chuck. Some agent just threw it at me, and it was so low, and it was on an off night, and I thought, well, maybe I ought to try the old boy once again. So here came the night, and, you know, Chuck, I saw him sitting at a table with a white lady. He always had a white date that he brought in with an older woman, not the same one. But he's sitting there, and they're all talking and stuff. And I went up and said hello to him and told him that, you know, everything was ready for him and that I'd give him 20 minutes notice when time came. He said, that'd be great. It was very nice. And I went away and didn't think any more about it. And he got up and left. And he came back maybe 15 minutes later and sat back down with this gal. And I looked, and it was time to go, so I go up to him and Chuck, it's time to go, and I'm looking at his eyes and they're all glassy. a lot of people didn't know he was a morphine addict.
Oh.
You know. Oh. And he would go out every time you see him, he'll go out and get some of that and, you know, crank it up. Well, he came back and got on the stage and started playing with this band. And you know, he would never rehearse with them or anything like that. He said, just watch my left foot and you'll know what to do. You know the tunes already. You know what key we're in. He didn't say that on the front of anybody, but that's how they did it. And so they started out, and he was, you know, playing pretty well and going back and forth across the stage. And eventually he went towards one side of the stage, and instead of turning around, he went down into his duck walk and started doing it backwards across the stage and playing at the same time, which he was very good at. But he didn't judge very well where he was, and he went right off the side of the stage, not the side, but the front of the stage, which had a couple of empty tables, and he fell right into these tables and stuff. Crash! I mean, it was spectacular. But he didn't stop. He didn't miss a lick. He kept playing all the way through that thing and slowly clambered up to his legs and got it back up on the stage. And, of course, the crowd went nuts. You know, they were just loving it. So that made most of the day.
Yeah, well, at least he was...
I know I got off the...
it was a great story.
Getting a little long here.
All right. Now, we've established that you and Jack Kalmes and several other people have decided to go into business together with a club.
We didn't have the club until a couple of years later. Okay. We went into business. We're incorporated in... Although we've been doing shows for a couple of years,
okay.
By then we incorporated in 65, and we were on the way out to our attorney's office, and a guy worked for my dad out in Arlington who was going to do the paperwork for us, and it was an attorney out there, and we were on 30 out there heading towards Arlington, and we said, what are we going to call this? You know, we don't know, and everything. Jack said, "What do you want to call it?" I said, "What?" He says, "I don't have a clue." I said, "Well, I'm just thinking about bringing it down to simple." I said, "Call it the Show Company, which is what we do, and shorten it to Showco." Bingo! We thought it was great. We turned in, we went in and told the attorney what we wanted to do, and he says, "Oh, that's a shitty name." That's a horrible name. I said, "Well," he said, "Why?" He said, "Well," he got kind of sheepish, and he said, "I told a client of mine one time to name a company that he had Chromeco, and it folded in about a week." You know, he said it just reminded me of that. So that's how the name came about.
That's why he's an attorney and you're an impresario. So that was 1965.
Yeah.
That you got incorporated. What, as you knew it then, what was the business plan? What were you guys going to do?
We had a business plan. It was tomorrow the world, you know. What was our business plan? We just did a little bit and then did a little bit more. We always had the business at that time was really, really depended on a number of frat parties and the same kind of thing you would find at UT. Frat parties, birthday parties, weddings. It eventually got into the adult kind of things, you know. It wasn't just rock and roll. It was all kind of music. We just learned how to get out and make calls and find out whatever one of my clients was looking for. And most of the time it worked. But it got to be where it was real steady. And we had eventually... We had a list of about 1,500 bands that were all around in the whole Southwest that we had figured out what they played and what their fees were and stuff, which was not to say that we booked all these people, but we had them available at any time. We had a lot of stuff that was available, and we sold it pretty well. And then, you know, then there was always, you know, kind of super parties, you know, things that... I remember booking, I don't know how I booked this, but I remember booking a party for some men over at Brook Hollow Golf Club one afternoon that had a band, you know, a good-sized band, and Stevie Wonder. He was the leader. This was before he hit the big time with, you know, those few albums that he really did. But it was about when... he had played our club, too. He'd also played there. It was about right about when I Was Made to Love Her came out. You know, okay. That was huge.
That was a great song.
And He's on stage at Brook Hollow. None of these guys have ever heard his name. And they start, you know, he starts playing and they're kind of going, what is this and what is this? And it gets more and more weird and interesting. And at the end, after about three songs, they're just all falling all over themselves trying to applaud this guy. You know, they didn't know who he was, but he was, that was one of Stevie's hottest times, really. I mean, as far as what he was putting out vocally, I thought. And he was terrific to be around. But wait a minute now, I'm off the subject again. Where we were talking about, oh, well, it was that type of thing, one-nighters, somebody's 50th birthday, a lot of weddings and stuff. Those were the big time. And they'd pay a lot of money. You know, it got to be where people would just kind of say, give me a $10,000 band, or I want a $5,000 band. You didn't even have to bargain with them, you know. You just stuck somebody in the slot there. I mean, we always did somebody good, but we had to make money, so we did. Anyway, it was fun to deal with people that really appreciated good music, and it was a real hard sell to booking rock and roll in those days to parents, you know, who didn't really understand. Sure. In a lot of cases, what they were getting. But they were depending on their kids to tell them it was good, you know, whatever it was good.
From the description of the things that you've told us about up to this point, it's very clear that this was local, regional, very, very Texas-based, maybe North Texas-based, maybe a tri-state, but at the most regional. What was kind of a turning point for you and for Shoko that started putting people like this guy behind you? There's a picture of a guy behind you that's a very famous picture. him. And let's take it up to like the summer of 1969, 50 years ago.
A lot of water under that bridge. I mean, before 69. 69 was kind of the end of it for me.
Okay.
I mean...
Well, take me from you know, booking frat parties and Brook Hollow to that point. Go ahead and tell me that interim period then. Don't let me rush.
Well, it was just
let me rush you.
Yeah. That era following, listen to me, those few years following.
There's a lot of living in those years.
Well, we had upped it to where we would do a Market Hall show every New Year's Eve and every OU weekend. So we went, and each year we'd tell our customers that, you know, like the first time we did it, it was the first time. The second time we did it, it was the third annual. Third time we did it was the seventh annual, stuff like that. And we mixed them up between the New Year's and New Year's and OU, so you couldn't tell what was going on. I had a couple of, one thing that happened, you know, that was just kind of parenthetical, but it did make a lot of sense with me. It was about in the winter of 67, it was in about the middle of December. I was at my apartment over in Oak Lawn, we were getting ready for the New Year's, big New Year's party that was to follow. I'd booked Otis Redding to play, headline that thing. And it was, as it turned out, you know, there's a kind of a pecking order amongst bands, and those they still have it, to see who can, you know, who's making what amount of money on their dates.
Sure.
Well, I knew what business he could do here, and he had never really played for an audience like that. He'd just played in a couple of clubs here. And I knew that it would be a good thing to put him in there, but the price was a little high. You know, because he had never reached this plateau, we decided to fall in with behind it, and we offered him $7,500. That was the price at which you knew you had made it in the rock and roll local rock and roll, local, you know, local or not.
That was a lot
that
of money.
That was the price. Yeah, and he
that was.
Was
a lot of money in 1967.
Well, he was going to make, that was his first time that he was going to perform under those circumstances. But I was sitting in the apartment in December, and here comes the radio announcement, you know, Otis Redding's gone down in his plane and everything. And it just really knocked the wind out of me.
It was awful.
Totally nuts.
It was terrible.
But it didn't, you know, it didn't keep us from doing anything. It just kind of, we had really been spending a lot of time with our own personal time on all these things up until that point. So I guess I was winding down a little bit, but we went ahead, got into 68, and that's when that picture was taken
that
out
was
at Love Field.
Just
not didn't have anything to do with anything except I knew he was coming. You know, I had my girlfriend was flying for Braniff in those days, and she called me at the office one morning and said, "Hey, I'm coming from San Antonio. I got Jimi Hendrix on my flight. Why don't you come out and see us?"
No kidding.
So I just jumped in the car and drove out to Love Field,
parked,
and walked right out onto the tarmac, you know, because they didn't have any security in those days. I just walked right out to where the thing came down, you know, and he was coming down. I said, "Hi, Jimmy, I'm Angus." You know, he said, "Hey, man, where am I?" he had dropped some acid before he'd gotten on the plane, and he was feeling no pain at all. So she had a little one of those little disposable cameras with her, and she took a couple of shots, and that was one of them that made it.
You know, that is one of the most iconic photographs of anybody I know. I mean, anybody that I know personally, that photo is like so famous. And it's just so sweet of mm-hmm. both of you. It's just a great photograph.
Well, you go back, it's fun to, you know, a lot of different people have posted that as their number one, you know, not a number one, just posted it. And they were the first ones to post it. But that happened a lot of different places, so that this thing was going around the world all the time. Every time it was posted, and there were thousands of people on that. You can still go back on Facebook and track it all the way back to when it was shot.
That's where I saw it. I just
I couldn't believe it. People know about
either.
It. We get mail. I used to get mail from people in, you know, Sweden and, you know, and God, and places I never heard of. Some over near Japan and so on and so forth. Hendrix is God, you know, that's the deal. Clapton came close, but Hendrix ran away with it, you know. And I was lucky to get to see his show here, you know. It was just really fabulous. He's a great guy.
That was just a pure meeting. You hadn't actually booked that gig.
No, I didn't book him.
Okay.
I never really did get a chance to book him. He wasn't, you know, he was only in business for about 18 months.
That's right.
I mean, that's his whole career in that period of time, and he never got paid a cent for any of it. Yeah. He got robbed more than any human you ever saw.
Yeah.
Mob owned him. They kidnapped him. They did every kind of thing they could to him to keep from paying him money. He never saw any sales money from sales of his records. None of that stuff. It's just a tragedy. Anyway, I found this out from a guy that I knew that was in New York that had booked him, you know, for a good while. And he told me, this guy has assembled the biggest collection of Hendrixiana, I guess you'd call it, that I've ever heard of. And he's writing a book about it now, because there's so many dirty deals back in there that no one's aware of yet. It's a shame.
It is a shame. Well, let me pull you. We've got you to about 1968. It sounds like the Shoko business is going really good, booking all these things. You're still booking regionally. What's the plan? How big of an organization would it have been circa 1968? It's you and Jack and...
Well, we had...
What?
We had a secretary, Camilla Carr, who'd been there with us since the beginning.
Okay.
And I'd stolen her from her hostessing duties at what was the name of that place? you know the club that was on Knox. No, it was on Knox. You know, it's where the old theater used to be. It had that little ZZ Top, the guy from the paper, Rolling Papers, up on the building there. Yeah, yeah. It was called
the Marfa Man.
Huh?
The Marfa Man?
No, I know what he meant.
No, it was called the
Rolling Papers guy with the Burt News.
For a while, it was called the In Crowd.
The In Crowd.
And then it was called Phantasmagoria. The guy that owned it tried to pick up on, you know, some kind of gimmick everywhere he could.
Okay.
And why did I say that? Oh, that's where I found Camilla.
Okay.
And the we had various and sundry people come in and do things for us when we needed them, but most of our business was on the phone, you know, so
right.
we had to be there and ready. It went along pretty well there. 68 was a good year. And right just beyond that was when we lead up to it, or enter the guys from Atlanta that came in mid-69, who had done the festival at Atlanta Pop and invited us. They came to town looking for a promoter they could hook up with and do another show, and we got the deal.
Okay.
Even though Terry Bassett came over and threatened us in our own offices, we had to tell him to take a hike. He says, "I'm supposed to be in that show." You know who I'm talking about? The guy that ran Concerts West.
Oh, really?
As a beginning.
Was that your first taste of the wild and woolly aspect of?
Oh, it went wild by a minute. That, you know, this guy fancied himself an LA mover and shaker,
okay.
You know,
okay.
So it was going to be like that.
Okay.
And he's a nice enough guy. We got to be friends later on, but we told him to take a hike
at
that point.
So these people from Atlanta that mm-hmm. had done Atlanta Pop, was this the first... or the biggest show that Shoko was about to do or had an opportunity to do? This was going to be it?
Oh, yeah, nothing topped festivals because, you know, there were no facilities that would hold that many people then.
Right.
And people liked the idea of getting back to the earth and everything. You know, we just went out in our cars looking for somebody. We didn't know we were going to do this till 40 days out.
Really?
You know, And it was wild and crazy from that point on. Everybody had something they had to do. I remember going out with a few guys. We had about five cars full of us all go out and fan around the county looking for a place that had good access and a big field. That's all, and had, you know, where we could get power and phones, you know. And we wound up in all these cornfields and stuff and places that had no real access to it. Oh, we can build a road here. Yeah, sure.
Build a road.
Well, I mean, two cars wide. It wouldn't have cost that much, I don't imagine. Anyway, we wound up with that Dallas International Motor Speedway, which none of us had ever been to. And it was a very nice facility. It had a big tower out there that was there until the end. It had an oval, it had a straightaway, and it had a hell of a lot of seating out there. But better than anything, it had a big parking lot, really huge. And we only wanted it for the parking lot and the field that was adjacent to it, which was just this big, wide open field that was bordered by a big forest that went around, you know, right off the service road of the highway. And we figured, oh yeah, we can get everybody in here. And I never really went down to one of the end of the lines, but it was probably a few mile or so long, you know, when the people first started coming. We chose that place. They were very nice to us, and wasn't for that we would have been up the creek. I don't know where else we would have done it. I don't remember any second place
There was no plan B.
Well, no, we said, here, we'll take it. Now, bring that load in.
Okay. Now, what was the lineup? And who did the booking? Did you do the booking, or did the
it was split
Atlanta
between...
do the booking? Or
well, Atlanta had already... Atlanta had a leg up because... I mean, I'd booked a lot of the people that were on this already, but there was a big feeding festival that was going on that summer, because we were booking our acts the same time Woodstock was.
Wow.
You know, and we were all going for the same acts.
Wow.
And the same acts wind up playing Atlanta, then played for us, and then played for Woodstock, you know. No, Atlanta, then Woodstock, then us. That was the order. And apparently, you know, the best and the worst happened because of that, because everybody all of a sudden understood after Woodstock what a pop festival was. But on the other hand, a lot of parents didn't want their kids going anywhere near a scene like that, even though there was no... I went up to Woodstock.
You went?
Yeah, I went at the last minute. My dad was going on some business meeting up in New York, and they would put their planes in what the hell is that airport? It's the place where all the hotshots, you know, go to private planes to New York instead of going to one of the air places there. Four of us got on this plane with him and went up there. And he dropped us off. We rented a car and started driving, and we got about 6 miles away from the place and finally had to stop and just park the car there on the road. And we made it down the road.
Wow.
And not very much time. You could hitch a ride sometimes. There was some motor thing going through there, one lane only. And other times there was nothing. You know, you just walked. But I remember coming up finally to get to them. You could hear the audience. Nothing was happening yet. It didn't happen until later on that day. But we went off over this berm and saw this big bowl down there with all of these people in it. I mean, it was insane looking. It was just, you know, I'm thinking, oh yeah, this is great. Then I looked down by my left foot, and there's this big roll, huge roll of Cox fence that has not been unrolled yet. And apparently these rolls of Cox fence were scattered all over. They were supposed to have been put up the day before. Never. None of them ever got up anywhere. And not wasn't too long before, here comes my old buddy Chip Monk, who was the brilliant lighting designer, they made him into the MC on the spot, you know, without, he didn't even know it. And he said, "Well, ladies and gentlemen, this, from now on, this is a free festival. You know, everything's free. You know, because there wasn't anything to take anymore. You either had a seat or you didn't." But we had made a deal with Hanley Sound, the guys that did the sound bit, and who's stuff was being used at Woodstock. We had already booked them for our show, and we said, "Oh," we called them up a couple of days before and said, "Hey, have some backstage passes there ready for us when we get there." Those things were like platinum, you know. And we got there and walked up to this little guy that was in a booth and said, told him who we were. And he says, "Oh yeah, I remember this." And he says, "There's a band that didn't show up, so I'm going to give you their passes." And He put mine's right there behind you, propped up in a little plastic case.
Oh no, kid! We've got to get a shot of that.
And it says "Iron Butt Fly" on there.
Iron Butt Fly.
They were going to give that to the band because they were the last ones there, you know. But they wind up, their manager, they call their manager. He says, "Oh, it's crowded here," and at the airport, and he says, "Don't get out there. I've heard all about it. It's madness. You can't. It'll never get on stage." So they never show. They were the only band that never showed, and we got their passes. So
I
got to spend a lot of time backstage. It was a lot of fun. I mean, literally, a lot of those movie shots you see, I'm standing behind the cameraman or one thing or another. He had something. He didn't even have that good a thing.
Wow. So
that's massive.
Did the experience encourage you, discourage you?
We were already in. We were locked in.
Too late?
Yeah, because we were in 2 weeks.
Oh, gosh.
It was every
gosh.
Every 2 weeks was the kind of the way it happened. And we already had all our acts booked and everything. We used a guy named Jerry Kushnick. He was an attorney in New York who was connected to a lot of different acts. He was a manager he wound up being the manager for, what the hell is their name? You know, the guys that played out in front of the stage, didn't make it this year. Grand Funk Railroad, okay, and some other acts that they were close to, because he had helped them book Atlanta, and they were. Only a few of them had been in the business, just like there were only a few of us here that had done it too, so we weren't scared of it. But it did start getting to look like we might have bitten off more than we could chew. Until all the people started coming in the gates, and it was a lot better, a lot easier to take at that point.
Besides Grand Funk Railroad, can you recall, just off the top of your head, who else you booked for the Texas International Pop Festival? Okay.
All those
Make
people.
Make sure you get a shot of the poster before we leave, please, guys. The whole original lineup, it's a beautiful poster. And it's got the whole lineup. There's a lot of people that were booked. A lot.
So Grand Funk isn't on there, I don't think. Nope, they're not on there because nobody knew they were going to be.
Okay.
They were going to come. They had a manager named Terry Knight.
Yes.
Terry Knight and the Pack.
And the Pack.
And he would get down on his knees and sing "I Who Have Nothing," you know.
Not very well,
right.
Though.
Nah. Yeah. And he kept bugging us to let him in. Well, we had to turn acts away for a couple of weeks because we didn't have any space, any room for him.
Right.
And he finally said, okay, you know, I mean, I'll do it for nothing. And we said, still can't do it.
Wow,
so I'll pay you $1,200. Hey, you just got a spot in front of the stage.
We just had an opening.
We got three big pieces of plywood and set them down in front of the stage and let them open every day. And they got, they got to be very popular off of that. They really made their career.
And you know what? They remember, because I've interviewed them and they've told me the same story and confirmed that that's true. And they appreciated it very, 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 very much.
Well, I was really looking. We had booked them for this year's show. And as it turned out, they had to cancel because of the hurricane. The hurricane hit. They all live in Florida now, so it all hit. And it was tearing up their houses and everything. And I couldn't have expected them there. They really wanted to come.
That's too bad.
They're one of my favorite live bands because of their singer.
Yeah.
You know, you remember him.
Oh, Mark Farner.
Yeah. No, because of the new singer.
Oh. I don't know the new singer.
Well, you remember a band called Jack Mack and the Heart Attack?
Sure.
He's that lead singer.
Oh, he's good.
Yeah, Max Carl. Max Gronenthal.
Yeah, Gronenthal.
He was one of the great white soul singers
he's
of all time. He's still with him.
I didn't know he's with him. He's a nice, very nice man, too.
You bet.
Cool. So, what was the post-mortem on the Texas International Pop Festival? I was told once by the late Bob Kelly, the promoter of Mid-South Concerts over in the Memphis region. I asked him one time, we were standing on the floor of the Liberty Bowl, and I said, Bob, we were about to do a big
Liberty Bowl
show.
In Kentucky?
No, in Memphis.
In Memphis, all right.
And I said, Bob, how come you guys don't do more outdoor concerts? These are great. And he says, I'll tell you what, Redbeard, he says, you either win big or you lose
That's
big.
Right.
There's no middle ground.
rain had killed us. It would have. Well, it rained. We got some rain on the first one, one of the afternoons, but it was so hot nobody cared. You know, they didn't. That's not the only reason nobody cared, but it was not a bad item for us.
So, you know, Pavlovian thing, or how was it for Shoko, the Texas International Pop Festival? Was it a good day? Did it put you on the map, or was it a? Did you lose your shirts?
Well, we did have some investors besides ourselves. We had already learned this from the other guys, as you know. He said, "Don't put your own money into these," and you know, because it's high stakes kind of stuff. And what kept us from making a profit on there was when we went to was seeing what had happened at Woodstock. When we came back from there, bound and determined not to let our fences be eliminated, as it were. So we hired a whole bunch of guys on horseback to ride that fence all the time, and it wound up costing close to $100,000. You know, eventually.
Wow.
Not just them, but some other, you know, some other stuff that were kind of like it. Anyway, that's about where we were in the hole at the end of the day. And that was more because we were spending more on some items than we had counted on originally, but would ostensibly save the whole day if there were a real threat to the circle that went around us, basically. And we had a guy that was our head of our security department was a guy named Ralph Adams, who up until that point had been the chief of police, that is, him and two other guys at the city of Louisville. That was their whole department. And when we got out there, first thing we did was ask the people that were out there if there was some security people around. And they said, well, all we had was a chief of police, and he had already resigned after his term was up and was playing off the 2 weeks final, you know, to get his money at the end, and he was hanging around, and we went up and said, "You want a job?" Basically, it took a little while because he didn't know what hippies were either, but after he hung around them for a while and they just kissed his ass every which way, you know, he became a big fan. It was one day when they, I don't even want to go there, but this can't go on there. But they, we had a compound down where we built our stage. We had a family of hippies living down there, a bunch of them that were really good, and they were building, you know, stages and shops and stuff like that. And they had a communal dinner every night, and the girls whipped up all this great food. And one time, we invited the mayor and the chief of police to come down and have dinner with us. And I didn't know about this until it was all over, until it was being done. But these girls put a whole lot of pot into the spaghetti sauce, and everybody ate it. And they had all this furniture out there, couches like the one you're sitting on and stuff, just outdoors. And these guys ate it along with us. And one of them said at one time, I can't remember which one it was, "Ooh, that moon up there is bright tonight." Another one said, "Yeah, and it's big too." You know, went on back into conversation. They weren't out of it, but they were definitely on another plane. So they got a little experience that tickled me a lot. I don't know where we are now. Let's see.
Well, I'm just wondering, on balance, you know, how did the Texas International Pop Festival affect Shoko going forward?
It had some effects on it. I mean, really, we just kept doing what we were doing, but in a very little amount of time, you know. By then, let's see, that was 69. I'd been doing these for six, almost 7 years. I mean, I started doing shows when I was 18, when I was at school. And I was just flat tired of it, you know. I needed a break, and I told them, you know, good luck. I'm gonna take a vacation for a while, maybe a year or something like that, which I did. But in the meantime, Jack had gotten together with these partners, who all, you know, I grew up with Jack Max, and we went to school together, and we all knew each other all that time. He was the only one out of them that I knew well. By then I knew Jack real well too. And, you know, always looking for a deal, you know, somewhere, just like I was. Well, I didn't really care that much about it then, and I wanted a break, but I just wound up taking off. And I can't remember what month it was after that, but it couldn't have been that long, because when I was at Woodstock, one of the more interesting, to say the least, bands that I ever saw went out and just tore the sound system up. You know, they just, and it was a Mountain, you know, a trio. And what's it, Felix Pappalardi
on bass and vocals.
Right.
Leslie West on that little white guitar.
That's right. Cut right there. And in the meantime, they were working on they saw how the sound system worked that we had hired to do up there. And every time something went wrong with it, they'd have to tear a bunch of shit out of it to repair it properly. And I don't understand how they could have put it together. There was hardly any of the cabinets matched even. There was a lot of this real old stuff. But it really put out a lot of noise, you know, when they had to. But they were watching it, and then they got a glimpse of what these guys were getting paid, and they said, "Well, we're in the wrong business. You know, we got to get out in front of this somehow. Let's start building some speaker systems that are modular that you can deal with on a show like this." And hell, I mean, you know, they live. Maxon lived around the corner from me on Beverly, and they have shut up. Put a little shop into his garage there and started building the speaker cabinets, the pyramid cabinets. And I helped him make, you know, design a disco controller. They were going to use those same things for discos. They just put a little piezo in it or something to keep it high end. It was let's see, where was I? I lost track. Oh yeah, well, they started building these things, and Jack said, I've got an offer for you, and he sent over an offer. Which I took, you know, which was, I'd deed over my end of the business to you, you know, but I don't want y'all competing with me either. They didn't want me competing with them, and I didn't want them competing with me, but I wasn't real confident that they'd be able to do any shows on their own. You know, it wasn't that kind of group at the time. Jack may have been able to do some of it, but he wasn't in touch with the New York and LA agencies as I had been, you know, up to then. So anyway, I figured it was a good swap. He owed some money on an old note that we said we'd forgive if he, you know, if they followed the terms of the agreement. And bang, they were in business. Anyway, they were just getting the finishing touches on this system, and had enough to, you know, build some columns on the side of the stage. And I get a call one day from Calmes, and he's real excited. He says, Angus, we booked a show. We booked a show. And I said, oh, wow. Who'd you get? They said, I don't know. It's some act called Mountain. It's at McFarlane. These guys were some of these guys that were, everybody was in competition to see how many linear feet that they could have, you know, double stacks of speakers up there, right. Cabinets. And he had it in spades. And I said, you guys better be doing it right, you know, because this is a tough act. And they said, okay. Well, I went down there to see what happened, and they had set up the speakers on either side, and they had gone down into the
orchestra
pit to mix and stuff. Like, they could hear anything down there. I mean, they could hear, because the first thing happened, he comes out, and dun-dun-dun-dun, you know, and everybody says, what? Dun-dun-dun-dun, and then he says, there's no vocal. Nothing coming through the vocal.
Uh-oh.
Either that or it was so loud from the guitars that they, you know, it was just oblivious. You know, no one could hear it. So they had to stop the show and try to redo everything. They finally got some interesting mix that I didn't stick around for because it wasn't my favorite act. But I warned them, you know, I told them. And they got better, obviously, after that. And they pulled in some really brilliant talent. And, excuse me, I didn't know you were in the room. I didn't mean to embarrass you. I wasn't following that part so much. I really wasn't doing anything except driving around. I bought a VW camper and made good use of it, you know, in those days, driving around in the Colorado and New Mexico, and drove down to all the way to Puerto Vallarta with it once. Out on these dirt roads. They didn't have any highways then. It was so dangerous at night, you know, be peeling across these plains that just went on and on and on. You couldn't see anything. There were no lights.
Wow.
You know?